Right, good afternoon. So I am Nesli Akdeniz. I am an assistant professor and extension specialist at UW Medicine. And today we will talk about GHG emissions from manure application. And this is going to be a team effort. We have Becky Larson. So after me, she will be speaking. She has research related to field measurements and modeling studies. I believe it will be a summary of all of those. We have Kevin Shelley, so he will answer some of the difficult questions. This is what he signed up for. And we have Diane Meyerfeld. So yeah, we are all with the UW Medicine Extension. So my part will cover the grazing operations. So in the past, all the animals were outside. Even some pigs were outside. Then we decided to put all the animals inside, right? And then now we are thinking, maybe we can put some animals back outside, right? There are some benefits. It doesn't apply to all operations, but there are some benefits. And one of the benefits is, according to one study, so the net income, not the income, but the net income from grazing operations is higher compared to the confined operations, since there is less input, right? Maybe there is less output, but there is also less input. There are some environmental benefits, right? Some fields are not meant to be, you know, crop fields. So no matter what you do, you cannot prevent the runoff. So there are some environmental benefits of having pastures. There are some climate benefits, right? This is what we are here today. So there's that carbon sequestration potential of the pastures. And it is always nice to look at a pasture, right? There are some biodiversity benefits. So it's always nice to see trees, pastures, and animals outside. They look happy. So there are those kind of benefits. All right. So the idea is pastures are regenerative agriculture, right? So they are self-sustained. So 60-80% of the nutrients are recycled back by grazing animals. And if there are some legumes, those legumes, they also help, right? They just fix the nitrogen. So the general understanding is we don't need to apply any nutrients. We don't need to apply manure. We don't need to apply compost to pastures. But that is not true, right? We need to have a nutrient management plan for pastures too. So our rotational grazing handbook, it recommends nutrient application to all pastures with less than 40% legume content. And it is important to, you know, pay attention to this recommendation, since the pasture quality in Wisconsin and the number of pastures is declining. So it is a good idea to maintain the quality. All right, so what are the benefits if you apply nutrients to pastures, right? The first benefit that we are expecting to see is improved yields. So simply, nutrients are recycled back. When you apply nutrients, you never lose those nutrients. They're always recycled back. And then if you can improve the yields, we can improve the carbon sequestration potential of the pastures. And I think one of the benefit, main benefit that we are looking for is we are looking to extend the grazing season, right? So that hopefully we don't have that drought. Mother Nature helps a little bit. And then now the seasons are shifting. Maybe the pasture season was from May to October. Now probably much more like mid-May to November. So we can extend that grazing season. So what, when we apply those nutrients, we are a little bit worried about the air emissions coming out, right? And what are those air emissions? So we know the gases, right? Ammonia is the first thing that comes to our mind. When we think about ammonia, it's the nitrogen-containing gas. The rest of them, they also come, right? There are NOx, N2O, and there are some carbon-containing compounds, right? CO2, methane, H2S. And then we are not only thinking about gas emissions, there's also dust coming out, right? Particulate matter. So we know PM2.5, we know PM10, right? There are some health concerns, we always hear about those. There is also another one is PM1, it's the very, very small one. So it is also a concern. All right, so when we look at these, which ones, like what are the greenhouse gases, right? So we know CO2, methane, and N2O, nitrous oxide. We heard about them many, many times, right? By now, we all know these are the greenhouse gases. Why are we worried about ammonia and NOx? They are kind of precursors, right? They are converted to a greenhouse. They are not a greenhouse, but they can be converted to a greenhouse. They can be converted to nitrous oxide. And then there are other, like dust or H2S, or total volatile organic compounds. Why are we worried about them? So it is not just those greenhouse gases that we know, not just those three gases. For example, PMs, dust, they have cooling or warming effect. We used to call it global warming. Now we cannot call it global warming anymore, right? We call it climate change. It's not just warming, but also cooling, right? Some of them have both effects. H2S, similar to dust, right? It is like attached to dust particles. Total VOCs, total volatile organic compounds, they also have that warming effect. So they are not as big greenhouses as the others, but they also have an indirect effect. All right, so this study is a little bit about measurements from pastures. So I read a lot of literature before coming here. I'm pretty sure Dr. Larson also will show you some results. So emissions from pastures versus emissions from confined facilities, right? Confined operations, which one is higher? And there is a lot of results, right? And the data is not, you know, data is here and there. So some measurements are based on modeling, some measurements are based on measurements. So this study is kind of trying to clarify what are the measurements, and they are all based on the measurement. So when we are doing this study, we didn't collect grab samples. We didn't collect, you know, 10 samples from a pasture. What we did, we attached our air analyzer to a drone, and we scanned the whole surface of the pasture. So we have a little bit better understanding of the emissions. And these are the three sites. So the first site, the picture you are seeing here, is from the Marshfield Egg Research Station. This is the UW Medicine's research station. So this is our controlled environment, okay? So we were able to put like two cows in one sub-paddock, and then we moved them. Everything was under control. So this was a kind of an excellent chance for us to measure our greenhouse gas emissions. The second one is a very, very unique farm. They have 600 cows on pasture. So it's a lot of cows on pasture, and the farmer loves it, so he just enjoys it. It's the way he does farming. And the third one is not a dairy farm, but it's a beef farm, so it just provides a kind of baseline for our studies. And the pastures were a kind of mixture of cool season grass and less than 30% legumes, so we needed to apply some nutrients. Okay, so this is what the air analyzer looks like. So you know the drone, right? So, and then we attach this black part attached to the drone is our air analyzer. Okay, so we all have got that remote pilot license, and then we were driving this one all around. So what we see here is this is the sampling probe, and I will talk about the sampling probe. There's a wind sensor at the end of the sampling probe. We have the air analyzer, and we have a bag. So we can do two things with this air analyzer. We can analyze the air when we are flying, or we can turn on a button, and then we can tell that analyzer, okay, stop analyzing, but filling up that bag. And then we take that bag back to the lab, and then we can use our GC or other instruments. So it's our quality control to make sure that all the measurements are correct. Okay, so this is what it looks like. One of the challenges here is it needs to be very, very light to be able to attach it to a drone and not drop it. Okay, so everything, all those sensors fit inside this small box. It is kind of very difficult to open, but I wanted to show you inside, so I somehow opened it. So there are many sensors inside. It is only 800 grams. Okay, there is that VOC, methane, NO2, H2S, ammonia, CO2, all the PMs, PM1, PM2.5, PM10, there is FN, there is also temperature, barometric pressure, wind direction, and wind speed. All, everything inside that box. Also, we have a weather station at the Marshfield site, so we can always compare our data to the Marshfield's weather station measurements. And this is the software. This is the pasture. So you see the dairy operation. If you have seen Marshfield site before, these are the dairy barns. They have dairy barns there, and this is the pasture. So this is where we collected our samples from. So this is the software. So one concern is we cannot just have that crazy flight, right? It needs to go at a constant speed and constant height. So there is an app, we just upload it, and it does it for us so that it doesn't require any expertise. And this is the software, what it looks like. So as you can see, it collected three samples, then move forward, three samples. There's one, two here, so if you don't see that one, it is pretty consistent and it's pretty flat line. And then this is kind of, it shows the average of these three measurements. So you can see temperature, this is just the battery, and then all these measurements here. So we have the relative humidity, and all of them are here. Okay. So this is a kind of closed-up look. So you can see this, we can attach it back, and then we can bring it back to the lab, and then we can do our quality control, just to make sure that our measurements are correct. Okay, so one of the things that when I, talk about air sampling using a drone, the first thing that comes to our mind is, okay, it sounds like a good idea. We attach an air analyzer to a drone, but then what happens to that wind downwash created by the propellers, right? It will affect, it will kind of dilute our samples, right? And then this is the sampling probe. They call it 88 centimeter sampling probe. So it is not like 40. So there are two pieces, 44 and 44. It's not like 40. It is very specific, 88 centimeter sampling probe. How do we know it works, right? Where is that idea coming from? So we did this smoke test, okay? And the sampling probe is heading to upwind. So wind is blowing in that direction. So whenever we collect samples, we do the smoke test just to make sure. We do understand where the wind is blowing from, but it changes a lot just to be able to, make sure. So as you can see, so this smoke, let's assume these are the air emissions, right? It comes and hits to the propeller, and there's a downwash, right? Here we can see. I adjusted the contrast of this picture so we can see easily. But as you can see, we are collecting sample here. We are using the sampling probe. It is long enough so that it, the propeller downwash doesn't affect our sample collection. Okay, so we use the software. So this is what the software looks like. There is a lot of interpolation and there is a lot of data crunching there. And then we will look at some of the data. So one of the challenges, we started this study in less than a year, so we just had this summer. So one of the challenges this year was the drought, right? So we did collect some samples, but I won't be able to show you like very solid conclusions or solid data. So we continue, okay? So this is kind of like you can see the Wisconsin map. There were counties that they were available for 4 months of payment for pastures. So all the pastures shut down early in Wisconsin this year. So like when we went to collect samples in August, there was no way to put that soil probe inside the soil, like it was so dry. So Mother Nature didn't help this year, but we are hopeful for the next year. All right, so this is kind of quick summary. There is a lot of data here. We don't need to go through one by one. But just to give an idea, so the average temperature was like within the range we were expecting, so 26 degrees C for Wisconsin summer, it is okay. Wind speed, we purposely chose those not windy days, so it was very low, 1.2 meter per second, and from southwest. This is what we are expecting, right? Wind blows from southwest in summer in Midwest. So one challenge was cows were comfortable having a drone around. It was kind of like if cows were not comfortable, if they were moving, if they were jumping or running around, then it may affect our measurements. But I think cows' eyesight is not that good. They didn't even see the drone flying around. Or they maybe thought it's a big bug, you know, just flying around, and they really didn't worry about that one. So CO2 concentration, so concentration, it doesn't mean anything, right? We are looking for emission rates. But as a reference, CO2 concentrations were slightly above the atmospheric CO2 levels. And this is something we were expecting since this is a pasture, there are animals and there is manure there, right? And then PM concentrations, they were also a little bit above the averages. VOCs were within the recommended limits. NO2 concentrations were a little bit high. The most important one, the CH4 and N2O, they were around a little bit above the atmospheric levels. All right, so these are the maps that we are looking, okay? So this is what's happening. This is a bit difficult to see. I need to change the color next time. This is sampling one, sampling two, sampling three, sampling four, and sampling five, okay? Sampling one is just after, one day after nutrient application. And sampling four is also just one day after. Sampling two is 1 week after sampling one. So 1 week later, and then there are two nutrient applications here, okay? So as you can see, the colorful, like the warm colors, red, orange, yellow, they mean higher emission rates. Bluish, greenish colors, they mean lower emission rates. So after we apply nutrients, there is a little bit increase in emission rates, right? This is what we are expecting. So this is for CO2. I will not show you all data, but this is for ammonia. As you can see, sampling one here, sampling four here, we can see those red dots, red spots a little bit more. And then NO2, it takes a little bit time. Since NO2 is converted from NH3, it takes a little bit time to pick it up, right? Sampling one is a little bit, what happened? Okay, a little bit lower than sampling. Sampling one is lower than sampling two, so it takes a little bit time, but it catches. So this is another example. So this is for total volatile organic compounds. And we are looking milligram per second per meter square pasture. So we are kind of standardizing the way we are looking at the data. And this is PM 2.5, so dust is completely different, right? So it's a little bit related to animal activity and other activity going around. And then, so what is next? What have we learned? So I showed you some data, and Kevin told me, please, please, please don't bore people with too many data, right? Your research is interested in, but what are the take-home messages, right? So these all pastures were rotationally grazed, so it's one of the recommendations we have. It's always a good idea to have rotational grazing. So I spoke with many, many producers, and they say, we don't apply nutrients to our pastures. And I was about to be convinced, okay, maybe like our rotational grazing handbook says we need to apply, but maybe we don't need to apply, they are not applying. But after this research, what I figured out that we need to apply nutrients. We need to have those soil samples, and we need to supplement our pastures. Otherwise, if you don't apply for 1 year, probably nothing will happen. But over the years, we are kind of abusing our pastures, so we need to supplement them and then try to increase the yields. Otherwise, we will be doing overgrazing, right? So one suggestion is, split application, don't just apply in May and then hope it works all year round, right? So we recommend split application in May and August, but August it really depends on the weather conditions. Hopefully drought will not happen. And then the next step we have is we will compare the manure. We call it like aged manure, or you can call it maybe compost manure application versus synthetic fertilizer application, right? So synthetic fertilizer, yes, NPK values are like more controllable, but we don't want to use synthetic fertilizers since we have a resource in our hand, right? We have manure, we have compost, so we want to be able to utilize them. And if we can somehow demonstrate the emissions are kind of like comparable or hopefully even lower, then we will be advantaged. And I don't know, it was maybe too quick. It's all I have. Any questions? So for this one, we used anhydrous ammonia, nitrogen fertilizer. So it was kind of two split applications. Any other questions? All right.
Will you do the follow-up, looking at comparing?
We are just starting, Diane. We are just starting. Yeah, there are a lot of questions there. Yes, we will be doing the comparison. And then this is just 1 year data, right? We need to, we couldn't get the whole grazing season, so we will be doing the whole grazing season next time.
Nestle, I don't understand exactly that second group of maps that you showed.
Mm-hmm.
That was from... were those manure applications or those were fertilizer applications?
Fertilizer applications.
Mm-hmm. On crop fields.
On pasture, in marsh field pastures.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't have used anhydrous ammonia for that.
Why not? We did.
Because they weren't organic pastures.
They were not.
But these were permanent pastures.
So this is the test field.
These were test fields.
Marsh field test fields.
Okay.
That they put out 2021 from the USDA. And you see that most of the greenhouse gases that are released are CO2. But then there's methane and then N2O. And why do we talk about those so much? Well, they're more impactful. They trap more heat over whatever year horizon, right? We love all these crazy ways you can look at it. But generally, they're not a huge amount of the gas it releases, but they have more impact sometimes. So like if you look at the sectors that they're coming from, if you combine the gases, so we use warming factors to combine those, where we say, oh, CH4 in a 100-year span is worth about 28 CO2s, right? So we make these factors, and then we combine them into CO2 equivalent, so we can make all these comparisons, right? That's what we're doing. Generally, people are using a 100-year horizon. Sometimes they're not. You've got to be careful for that. But in general, agriculture, all of agriculture in the U.S. is about 10%. You can argue, and we can say it's 12 or 8, whatever, right? The data like this big, there's always some interpretation to make. But in general, this is where it stands, right? Now, people might say we're only 10%. Like, focus on electricity, focus on transportation, get those suckers, right? Like, what are we doing? But as I think you've maybe seen, you know, we've passed some thresholds. I think we've already passed like 1.5 degrees C. So like everywhere we need to look at ways we can mitigate. And for me, the big picture is, how can we mitigate then? What is the effort that's going to take, and what is the cost, and what is the impact, and socially, right? There's a whole lot of other pieces that we need to consider. But a lot of the first steps are like, all right, if I'm looking at manure, what can I reduce, and how can I reduce it, and how does that compare to someone putting in a solar panel, right? And so how can I look at these things and maybe use my resources most effectively to try to reduce the impacts that we're seeing, right? That's the kind of big picture I like to say, and I love to put these slides out of the slides I put them in, but this is just to remind you there's a lot of different ways people look at this, right? So you can say methane is 28 CO2s, nitrous oxide is 265 equivalent, and they stay in the atmosphere for different. The only reason I mention this is the reason they target methane and nitrous oxide, particularly methane, because it's shorter lived, so if you can remove it and convert it to CO2, you can have an impact earlier, right? I could give a whole talk about that, but the idea is if I reduce methane, I might have a quicker term impact on one. I might be able to reduce that a little bit, and if I can reduce one methane, it's a lot easier than pulling 30 CO2s out of. Right, so we still want to make sure we do those comparisons. So when we look at a farm, livestock farms, generally we see enteric fermentation, number one, manure management, a little down the chain. I'm sorry, these are not farms, but these are the big two in farms. And we have livestock farms, enteric fermentation, manure management. Enteric fermentation is the biggest. It's always the biggest. It's a huge thing. Most cars burp out a ton of methane. You know, people think they fart out, but it's actually 95% of the methane is coming out of the mouth. Actually, I had a student in my 100 level class was like, why don't they try to catch that methane out of the cow's mouth? And they do. I don't know if you've ever seen, they have these pictures of they were trying to collect it in bags, trying to catch the gas, but not very effective. They also try a lot of feed supplements, right? And a lot of those show a little bit of, you know, seaweed, a little promise, another study shows it doesn't. I think the data is still, we're waiting to see a little bit if that's easy to impact. Even though it's the biggest category. Manure management gets a lot of target. Oh, yeah.
I'm just curious, what is normal enteric fermentation for? Like, I'm sure where it was, like, I mean, microbiome is going to be fermenting, right? So is there a normal level? I mean, we're seeing cows releasing more than that?
So humans, we release some, mostly through flatulence, but the microbiome in a cow's gut releases much more for probably human body weight. And so if you add up all the methane from humans, it's definitely less.
But I guess, I mean, is there a baseline for cows? Right, there's always going to be some, isn't there?
Totally. You're always going to have some.
I think the argument is we have more cows now than is, quote, natural, right? So
yeah, I'm just wondering if there's, like, that's never going to go to zero.
No.
Do we know what a baseline is?
We do know the average amount of cow produces. So we do have a baseline. And in a different presentation, I have some enteric fermentation mitigation strategies in which they show, like, oh, feeding practice, maybe I can get 10% off. And they actually, you know, I think in the last study we did, if we combined all the practices we knew we could do, work along the way too, right? So they use genetics. So they can use genetics to manipulate that to try to reduce the emissions from the cow. They can use feeding strategies where they try to get different feed that can create different methane content so that affects the community. They can do some things to kind of alter the community. So there's a lot of different things. And non-organic systems, they'll feed Rumensin, right? That might help reduce some little bit of that. So there's a lot of ways that they're just not very, at this point, I think in 10 years, we'll have like, hey, we've got a lot of strategies. Right now, I would hesitate if someone says they have the thing that is works so well. Yeah.
So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this argument that I've heard that the methane that's being emitted by cow burps is actually carbon that was already in the atmosphere anyway. It's just recycling between plants and air.
Sure.
The animals, and what's really causing the problem is the carbon we're taking out of the ground that is fossil carbon.
Yep. So I think there's two arguments there. One is like, so they call it biogenic, right? So when carbon is cycling, when it's through plants, a lot of times we ignore the CO2 when we're modeling things, right? Because we're like, hey, CO2 gets released from this, it goes back into a plant, and around it goes. And a lot of models you'll see ignore that biogenic cycle. We say, hey, that's just in a cycle. Methane, we don't do that with. Currently, most people are not. They're actually measuring the methane around in the cycle. And there's now some argument, people making some argument, that, hey, that methane is part of that cycle as well, right? You can make any argument you want. I'm fine with it. I'm not here to decide that for you. I will say methane causes warming. CO2 causes warming. And, you know, the reason we don't calculate the biogenic, another reason we don't do that for CO2 is because it's so small comparatively to the impact, right? CO2 emissions from agriculture would probably never run up on the energy production CO2, right? So the methane, we have the opportunity to reduce that. Now, if you're trying to get out there and say, hey, farms aren't that bad, whatever, I don't know, I'm not the one you got to convince on that argument. I would say you have some reasoning to say this might be part of the cycle and it's not really going to reduce it. That could be an argument that could be made. I will say our planet probably needs us all to make a little bit better effort. I will, you know, when it comes down to agricultural reductions, I stick to the theme, if we can do a little bit, let's look at what it costs, see what it is, and then look at the science of our options. In terms of what consumers think and what they're going to pay attention to, they're already not in the realm of science a lot of times, right? So I think we have to do better at maybe making sure people have the science so they can make more decisions. I tell my students all the time, in the end, opinion will come in, but it will be very nice if we can all start from a scientific base that we can generally agree about, right? Because opinions will come into the scape of, if you even agree that we need to reduce warming, then or climate change, then what strategies do we need to take and having the right science to back that? So, I mean, that's really my take, but I think the argument can be made, and scientifically, I think people are looking at that right now. I think in 5 years, you'll have a better answer. There are some people who I think are using, in a minute, I'll talk a little bit about our methods, using something called GP Star, which is starting to think about these sources a little bit differently. I need more data before I can really decide what the messaging of that might be. Okay, so regardless, and in these farms, methane emission, I don't like this graphic, one of my scientists made it. It just shows that like the bigger CH4 comes in different places, right? We also have one for, I couldn't find the one for pasture, but methane generally in terra is the big jump, is the big holder. The second holder is if you store manure, right? And so then everybody's like, we don't need manure storage. And as a manure person, I'm like, yes, we do, right? So if you're handling manure, there's other environmental impacts. Like climate change is really important, but if we're gonna do a system thinking, which I think we need to do, manure storage is really important for water quality, right? It helps us manage our manure, helps us like nutrient use efficiency, we can use it a lot better. bigger part of the water quality concerns, right? So it gets complicated as we start to layer environmental impacts and then social and then economic, right? So there's a lot of different things there. Nitrous oxide, manure management is part of that. Biggest thing is from soils. With a lot of N2O that comes from soils. Some of that's manure. Sometimes that gets put in that category when it's applied. We don't have a lot of control for that right now. I would say my recommendation for manure and nitrogen is the most nutrient use efficiency you can have, the best you can use your nitrogen and your manure and your other sources. That is the plan, right? There's not a lot of other ways that we know of yet. We're testing some things, working on things, but I would say just managing your nitrogen to not add excesses so you limit the losses is really the general plan there. Greenhouse gases, I only put this slide up because I'm going to talk a little bit about what we've seen and modeling and looking at the results. And we only look at the farm. So we like put this little, we call it boundary around there, right? But the reason is because a lot of studies previously looked at the whole, I'm going to talk about dairy in the beginning, then I'll talk about manure for everything in case you're not a dairy person, but we have so much dairy, that's what we do all the time. So I'm going to talk about this boundary around the farm because when others looked at, so many studies looked at all the background, the farm is always like 75% of the emissions. So more of the emissions come from the actual farm than do the post-processing out to consumers. I know people think transportation is so huge, but it isn't. It isn't in comparison to what we lose in methane and N2O. It just ends up not being as much as people think it is. Okay, so now I'm going to talk a little bit about a study provided with all this data, and I promise I won't be too intensive with data. And then I'll like show pictures about manure processing, which is so super fun. I know some people don't get excited. I do think I'm a weird nerd that I'm like, oh, look at your farm. I get all excited when I'm there and people show me stuff. So we'll talk a little bit about that. So the biggest thing is, so we have this big project with Organic Valley, and they've been giving us data where we've been modeling farms around the entire U.S., right? So we've been breaking farms down into categories. So like in the New England region, we model the different subtypes of farms. And what they did is they looked at all their data of all of the farms that contributed to them in organic systems, and they gave us the averages of a whole bunch of things. And the data for this, I mean, I could give you an hour presentation of all the data that went into this. It's insane. Nicole from Organic Valley and Horacio from My Scientist did all of this data collection, so I have to thank them very much that they put all of this together. And I have four regions up here. We're finishing the other four. This part's already published, so I figured let's stick to this for now. So we looked at all these different systems, right? You might have a grass bed. You might have somebody that's off-grid. You might have a bigger farm out in California where their averages were pretty big. Around the Midwest, they were a bit smaller on average, and we modeled some different farms. We modeled some Jerseys, some Holsteins, and we looked at the emissions. We were using life cycle processes, so we take all of this data from measured trials, from what's in literature, and we combine it all into this big assessment throughout the farm. Right? These systems views are really important, because you can make a little change in how you feed an animal and think, look, I got my enteric down 10%, then all of a sudden your manure emissions go up way high. What I will say is what was very interesting in this is we need so much more data on organic farms, like so much more. We are like so far behind in data collection. And so after this, we're like writing a million grants to more composting data, more manure data, like it's just endless. So we do need, the data quality concerns me in some areas, right? I'll say the enteric emissions, right? That's this green bar. It's clearly the biggest, right? It's always the biggest. And the equations we use to predict that are really important, right? And the equations, we looked at like 20 different equations. There's some common ones used here in the U.S., but mostly for conventional, which eat differently, right? Which have different methane production. There's a big study out of New Zealand, some out of Europe that's starting to compare this and saying, hey, pastures are different. And so we used one that was more closer to what we thought matched the data from organic pastures and then organic cows in general. But I will say no matter what organic system you're using, there's a limited data.
Thank you. Are those amounts total per farm or are they per some
use? So this is a total. Total per fat and protein corrected milk. So what I'm also going to tell you is whenever you see data, that's going to numbers go higher, right? Because generally, the feeding, the types of systems used in organic are a little less efficient in terms of milk production to feed intake, right? So the number per unit per milk is higher. When you switch to per land use area, organic systems come out looking better, right? So the information, the way you look at it, can change the outcomes, right? So it's really important. I would say you need to look at it in a lot of ways and understand what your drivers are. There was a recent study, I think, out of Wales where they were looking at, well, what if we switched our entire production system to organic and they would need more land base? So in the end, it was lower environmental impact, but then they would need to import food that wasn't organic produced, so then the environmental impact would go up unless they could find more land base for that. So there's a lot of things there. I'm always asking people, why are we comparing the two, right? There is room in the world to have two, many lanes of avenues of production, and to consider each production and the people who want to consume that and give them the information of how that's performing. In reality, these numbers are very close to conventional, because everybody always asks me that, I think.
They are similar to conventional.
Yeah, I've got another slide, but maybe I turned it off.
Got another slide. But, oh, the other thing I wanted to mention here, manure is the yellow and the gray, and if you're colorblind, someone told me this the other day, I'm very sorry, but it is like if you add those together are the second, generally the second. I think it's frozen.
It is
frozen. Oh, sweet, thank you.
So you can look at the comparison to lots of other LCAs. So, in most, like a conventional one, the average was 1.04, 0.7 to 1.5, right? So you can see all these variations, and up here we put the milk production, and you'll see when milk production's lower, the number's generally higher. And you have some other things that are throwing in this. What we're generally finding is in addition to this lower production, when you're looking at it in this terms, bedded packs actually have produce a lot of N2O, so they're having some impact. And then, what are some other big things? If you start storing manure, you're going to get more methane, like this 250 head in the Northwest. They start to get more methane from that. And a lot of times, your region in the country, if you're hotter, is going to produce more emissions, right? So comparatively, you might see that change. And then we also started looking at carbon sequestration, so that's that little blue part. And so the practices you might use might increase or decrease that part. So that's the part that we're trying to start integrating. That's kind of a new component. And so that that helps make the emissions look a little bit less.
Can you share what the average a little bit to where that came from?
Sure. Oh, this is generally, you see, like, look, these are both 1.27. The fat and protein corrected milk, the milk production is just lower from those systems. There is sometimes when they switch, so they aren't using electricity. So in some regions of the country, that drives it down where you get your electricity if there's a lot of fossil fuels. So I'll say, like, in the Midwest, we have a lot of fossil energy in the Midwest. If you're in the northeastern, like up towards Maine, you have a lot more renewables, so that's not really that big of a deal. But then there were some offsets of using other types of things that were really offsetting some of that energy use that that increase that particular farm. Okay, so in manure, you'll see, when does manure methane get really big? It's when you have manure stored, when you're losing a slurry or a more liquid system, right? That's not super common in organic farms, but it is in some of them, right? So we modeled these because in certain sizes, we started to see that was the handling of choice, right? And so you get more manure. I, again, would say, careful, and unless you want to move to composting or you want to do some other things, it's all right to have some increased emissions, and there's ways to mitigate that, right? We can also find other ways to mitigate that during storage or other things. So methane from storage just happens, right? It's the microorganisms are degrading that. That's their byproduct. They produce methane. You normally don't catch a manure storage on fire. I just like this. It's exciting. You know, this is one in Pennsylvania. but the longer we store it, it's because we store it for so long, particularly in the Midwest, because we're making it through the whole winter, modeled this yet, but emptying your storage, maybe to empty more frequently, would allow you to have less emissions, right? So there's ways you could maybe manage this to reduce it. I know that creates some strategies for cropping, but a rating system sometimes might have some opportunities. We've talked about that maybe in conventional always row cropping where you might be able to use some of the manure at different times that could make it more possible to use it more often.
Because it's less time as anaerobic?
Sorry if I didn't say that clearly. Less time that the microorganisms, it's sitting anaerobic, which is where the methane comes from. So the less time you can do that. You can also, if you form a crust on top of a slurry, right? So sometimes people want to remove more and more. Sometimes a crust can help reduce some emissions. So we see a little bit lower, but you do see a little more N2O. So the impact isn't super huge. Again, nitrous oxide in soils, it's out there. I should have mentioned too, for ease of use, that one slide was so big with all those data bars. But we broke it down into a grazing and non-grazing component, depending upon the farm, so that we could see the emissions. And then we put them together to get the average based upon the amount of time in that particular farm scenario that animals would be grazing. And so, you know, you see in the grazing period that N2O is more common, right? It's hard to control that because it can become more concentrated, right? If you're not, this was a big problem I saw in New Zealand when I was there too, is that you can't necessarily control the animals where they're putting the nitrogen. And when you get a really hot spot of nitrogen, that can generally lead to more nitrogen losses as compared to if you're spreading it more evenly on a field and other management ways. So you might get some more N2O during the grazing season from that particular component. I'm going to skip that because I have no idea how much time we have. If you're managing solid manure, the biggest losses are from nitrous oxide, right? If you look at this, if you're organic and you're managing solid manure, your losses from manure are mostly during from nitrous oxide in land application. And so is there a huge amount of ways we can manage that? Not right now. Not huge ways. But also, when you're handling solid manure, you're generally on the lower end of a lot of farms. So the more you can just be use your nitrogen the most efficient you can, the more you'll be able to knock that down. So one of the things we did is we looked at tons of management practices. We were like, okay, if I increase my milk yield, my GHG goes down. Like we did this on a million different model farm scenarios. So on average, you know, maybe 10%. Maybe I put a manure cover on my storage. Maybe that's 16% mitigation. Maybe I use a separator. I hit 7%. Maybe I change my replacement or my mortality or change my feeding strategy or I inject my manure when I'm putting it out in the field. So we looked at a lot of different strategies. And, you know, you see these and you're like, are these that big, right? But in terms of what Organic Valley was looking at and paying their things, these are the practices that they're assigning values to and paying money to support this reduction strategy, right? And so then we're also using different tools to make sure those tools now reflect accurately using organic data this shift and change that you see in all of these different farms and the data that goes into that. And you can combine them, and you can start to get pretty significant reductions if you start combining them, right? Okay. Now we're going to talk manure. Are there any more data questions? I know it's fast and it's a lot of information.
Yep. How did you measure the carbon sequestration?
The carbon sequestration is a method that was developed to look at the amount of carbon that was put out on the field and then integrated in addition to traditional carbon. So I have to look, there's a whole the list of how it is as long. And so my scientists found a method that used all of the existing information and made up there's some equations to predict the carbon sequestration based on a lot of the biomass and how you integrate that. And so it'll give you a fraction there. This is a very interesting topic that I think is going to never-ending develop. So right now, there is a lot of debate about what carbon sequestration is, how long does something have to be in the soil for it to be considered carbon sequestration. know, when I'm at other places and I see some soil scientists talk, a few of them are talking about, I really only think biochar is the one that will really last long enough to be considered sequestration. So, I don't know, we have our estimates, there's other estimates out there. I say there's many ways. I don't know that this one will become the one. There's, you know, the systems that are being used right now for modeling farms are like Cool Farm Tool, Comet, and they're using some different methodologies for that, and where they only measure carbon stored by practice change, so you have to measure practice change. I don't have great answers for you on how carbon sequestration, on what is the end game going to be on how you determine that. I wish you did. Good question. I don't know if anybody else wants to weigh in on that. All right, any other data questions? Now I'm just going to talk about manure stuff.
All this data was modeled based on models.
Yeah, so it's modeled, but that model, those equations were based on data that was measured. But this is what I'll say about that. So composting actually doesn't look so great in terms of emissions of ammonia and greenhouse gas emissions. And so we pulled all the literature together we could find on composting data. And it's pretty variable. And so there's a lot of different ways to compost. And I think a lot of researchers that did compost weren't necessarily saying how they were composting or how they were managing it. And anybody who composts knows that how you compost and how you manage it is really important. And so the IPCC and lots of other places that are using these equations to predict these things are using data that I would say is fairly questionable, right? And so that's, we've been trying to mark areas where we think we need more data. A lot of manure areas, pasture emissions are another piece that is really, the data's not so great, we need more data there. Manure storage, manure processing, enteric, the equations we're using for enteric and how they're relating to the particular farm system you're using. Most enteric equations that people are using for these systems are being developed from very conventional operations. And so we're noticing that there's a big difference in how are we using that. The equations are also really important because say you want to implement a feeding strategy change, and if that equation isn't using feed, like different components of feed, to predict emissions, you'll never see a change based on that practice, right? And so there's, the reason I'm saying all this is because there's tools out there now, right? And a lot of people are trying to use these tools because it's very complicated. And so Cool Farm Tool, Comet Farm, I think those are the two big ones. Maybe Farming SM Conventional, those are, you know, some of those are more dairy, but they're using those tools. And we're trying now to make sure anything we see in these organic things, that we're getting this data to those developers so that they can implement some things that we're noticing are maybe misaligning with what the most current data has. But I would say there are still many gaps. And so this is why, you know, a while ago when they tried to doing some EPA regulation of these things, and they were trying to, even if they could roll it out, that we weren't ready to be able to be in the beginning of measuring these accurately and understanding how it all affects. Now at least we have some, I think we're getting more refined, and then we know the practices can, if it's going generally down or up. And so the NRCS, I think, has a lot of EQIP dollars now that are going to be related to some of these practices in terms of emissions reduction. You're like, I didn't want that much information. That's my idea.
Could you go to the last slide for a moment?
Yeah.
And how common are some of these? Like manure cover and injection?
So that's what my scientists love, this manure cover, but I'm like, nobody does that. Nobody wants to do that.
Right.
Nobody cares, right? It's too expensive, and you're not really getting any return. I would say I see more.
It's done more in Europe, isn't it? Cabin.
Yeah, like cabin flare, I would say, you know, this is pretty equivalent to like digester. You're getting similar impacts. We've modeled a lot of digesters on conventional systems, but I don't see a lot of that in organic farms. So that's what I want to talk a little bit about. Some practices. So we were finding that replacement rate was, so organic farms kept animals for much longer. So the replacement rate makes the replacement rate longer.
Right.
So you have a smaller replacement rate, or average, or whatever. Okay. You
and
get what I'm saying?
Staying in the milking herd longer. Yeah.
Yes, there you go. Thank you. And so we were thinking, when we started modeling that, we were like, actually, in most scenarios, that's a positive thing. Like, it actually has an environmental benefit. Sometimes you would catch a time that it didn't. But what we don't think the models capture is all the pieces that are connected to that. And actually, there's not very good data on replacement rate. Even Organic Valley didn't have a lot of, they didn't survey a lot of their producers in terms of how, what their replacement rate was. So we were trying, to look at more and more what other things that might impact that need to change in the model, because we think that this number would will actually be more negative as we change that.
So do your the other graphs that you showed,
yeah.
Do they include the emissions from the replacement animals?
Yes. Yeah. So it's like a 150 cow Holstein farm, and it'll include all the replacement animals for that to support that herd. And we think those numbers could be different than what we might want.
I'm going to say if your animals are lasting 4 or 5 lactations,
that
as opposed
small.
To less than 2,
mm-hmm.
then you have fewer animals that are not
yeah.
producing milk and producing all
yep.
the same emissions.
And our model takes in a little bit of light and a little bit of herd change, but we actually think that it's bigger than what our we've modeled. So that's one of our list of next things on the list is to do a bigger dive into what the replacement rate actually. That's a very good point. All right. Any other things?
Injection.
Yeah. So applying manure. If
or,
you apply
or
manure,
just injecting manure.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep.
So incorporating, injecting, anything there can give you a benefit. You don't usually see a negative. Sometimes it's not a huge impact.
Are owls injecting manure?
I don't know. Some they might be incorporating, so they might have mixed that.
Probably
in. He might have. I think he was trying to give me.
I
my
see.
Scientist was kind of trying to give me. I was like, less graphs, less numbers. So he gave me this, and so he was trying to give me a hint of like what was in here, so that I wouldn't forget. But yeah. So I think they're using some incorporation practices. And generally, the numbers are pretty similar if you inject or incorporate within 24 hours. Okay, so just a little composting. We know, I would say there's so many wonderful benefits. And even if we come to the conclusion that there might be a little increase in it, I still think it's a system we should keep for many, many reasons. I also think the data suggests, if I look at all the 50 studies, that if you manage it the way that we recommend, like with more oxygen, the right carbon and nitrogen, that emissions, you can manage emissions, that they could go down, right? And one of the biggest things is that you don't want to lose ammonia in this process, so you have to be careful with aeration rate. And so we think maybe we can impact that with some management options. We're still trying to look at that. But that we can reduce that ammonia, because ammonia isn't a greenhouse gas. But when we model, when ammonia is lost, a portion of that indirectly turns into N2O. So we call that indirect N2O. And so a portion of that goes in there. And if you can keep ammonia, right, like you can lose 50% of ammonia, and I gotta replace all that nitrogen, that kind of sucks. So if we can retain that. Digestion's great. There are a few small farms with it on there. This is a 150 head farm. It's really hard to make this work financially at that scale. With the current incentives, I think it could be doable if you combine a few farms. So we're seeing somebody, but you have to make that transportation close enough that it doesn't become so costly. And the rates right now, you know, when people are getting some supplemental for all the energy credits, so the RIN credits and the LCFS and all these credits, and they're looking attractive enough. A lot of the investors were starting on the big farms because that's where they can make the most money. So now they're trying to look at the pizza farms, so there might be some changes in that realm. Still kind of a ways away. I think solid liquid separation, and when we modeled this, it can transition is great because it captures methane and it converts that and you use it for energy, so there's a payback system there, so that's totally awesome. And every CH4, once it's used in the end, it's combusted somehow, becomes a CO2. So you get that 30x reduction when I was talking before. I've turned a CH4 into a CO2 through the process of collecting and using it some other way. And so that creates a big benefit. Solid liquid separation, you separate the manure into liquids and solids. The more you can do that, there's not as much material for the anaerobic microorganisms to feed on to create the methane, right? You're removing some of that carbon out here, and the more you can store solid things, the less anaerobic it is, the less emissions you get from the separation system. There's lots of separation systems. They're not too expensive. We've actually seen a number of organic farms that are starting to put these in, enough that they want to know, like, oh, how do we measure efficiency, and how do we figure out all these numbers for the calculations? There's tons of different kinds. If you came to me one day and you're like, which one do I pick? Really depends upon your manure characteristics and what you want to do and what you want to remove. And they have lots of operational benefits where I might be able to use the liquid to irrigate my pasture, or you know, you can use the solid for something else. And like pathogens tend to stay in the liquids, almost all of them, like 95% or something like that. So you have a very lower pathogen content in the solid, so maybe you can use those in other places that might have more risk. So I know this is just to remind me, it's nothing you need to care about, but separation efficiency is really important. So in a separator, what we find is that like the ammoniacal nitrogen, all of the usable nitrogen ends up in the liquid. And in the solids, it's like all organic nitrogen. So in that component, you have to manage that a little bit differently. And so just heads up in there. So your separation efficiency, the type of separator you use is really important in that.
But, I mean, you mean not immediately available, smoke
right.
At least.
But we thought, oh, maybe it'll be later, available later in the year. Doesn't seem like it's available in the first year at all, almost at all. And so now we're like, oh, we gotta go into the second year. So it's not, I thought it would be available sooner than it is, so we're not really sure how long it's tied up. But the mineralization looks a lot longer than we first thought and estimated. But the important thing is, what I should stick to is the main message I'm trying to get, is that the separation efficiencies are really different. That means how much nitrogen goes in one or versus the other can change based on the separation system you're using. And that's really important because, for example, I just want you to look at this SLF one, right? This is how we were modeling it using numbers based on the solid separation. And then we're like, you know what? We need to model this based on actual collected data of how the separators operate and using how well it separates carbon and separates nitrogen and volatile salts and the things that are producing these gases. What we found is if you look at that, you can really get that number down. So if we look at it more to operate these things to shoot for lower emissions, we might even be able to bring that number down farther. So that's a pretty big change. This was like 5,000 CO2 equivalents per day per kilogram, I think, of manure, and then we're way down here for that one. So it's huge. That could really, that 7, minus 7 could be way smaller. Okay, ammonia is not a GHG. This is my last two slides, so don't worry, I'm almost done. But most of it is lost in land application, some in storage, and it converts to N2O, and it can create a whole ton of problems. And so we have a whole other model. I'm not going to show you 15 million slides of that. But we modeled a bunch of different scenarios of organic farms and look at all the ways. And unfortunately, composting doesn't look so great. Injection plus solid liquid separation. So I know this is hard to read, but there's like all the different farms are these, their baseline. Remember when you were asking, like, oh, is there a baseline of things? And then we model when you put the practice in, how does it change from that baseline for these different farms? So you can see, like, if I do separation injection, boom, that goes way down. Injection is really the primary component of that. Separation helps a little bit, but if you inject or incorporate manure, you're getting huge. I mean, that's like you're going from 3.5 down to like 2 point something, so a third or a half, you're getting, you know, 50% of that. So just a note, there's different impact categories.
You can usually jack up your soil erosion too.
Yeah, so then we measure that in other ways, right?
Right.
So there's other
But what about nitrous oxide and injection?
It's really not driven so much by that. So it goes down because you lose all that nitrogen, like if you just looked at a system, but then you gotta add more nitrogen, and so then the additive part, do you get what I'm saying? Like, if a lot of data will show, hey, if I inject, I have less N2O, but you've lost so much nitrogen, of course you have less nitrogen in the soil, you're gonna have less N2O produced. And if you add in enough more nitrogen back that you would need based on what you lose, then N2O goes up again. N2O is mostly driven by water moisture conditions, which we don't have a lot of.
Is it aerobic or anaerobic?
It's lost in both processes, unfortunately, so it goes in both ways, but it's most severe when you're going back and forth from dry and forming. So that really drives up N2O, which is why we don't have a lot of ways to mitigate that impact. And so people are trying to look at active, or how can I manage a field different, or how could I manage a moisture different? That's pretty hard to do, right? And so that's why I always say the best thing to do is just the amount of nitrogen is also a driver of N2O. So if you can put on the amount that's most, that you lead to the most amount in your plant, which nutrient use efficiency, that's the amount that you want to target. That'll help your N2O efficiency. And then we have tug effect sheets on all kinds of human processing, ammonia,